Welcome to the Learning Reinvented podcast, brought to you by myself, James Politillo, and the team at Learning Effect. There are lots of learning podcasts out there, so we wanted to do something slightly different. This week, we're going to explore a number of topical issues that are occurring in learning, kicking off with what do you do when you're managing a learning function through a bit of an economic downturn? I'm delighted to welcome David James to the podcast. David, do you want to introduce yourself to the listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, thanks, James. It's a pleasure to be a guest. Yes, as you mentioned, I'm David James, and host of the Learning and Development podcast. I'm also Chief Learning Officer at 360 Learning, a collaborative learning tech tool. Previous to my involvement on the learning tech side, I was Director of Learning Talent and Organizational Development for Disney, for Europe, Middle East and Africa. And when I left there in 2014, that was the sum of my 15 years of in-company, either being in learning and development teams or running learning and development functions.
And I know from your time at Disney that it was one of those times where we went through that sort of economic challenges at the end of the 2000s. So can you share some of that insight and learning that you had going through that downturn? Because a lot of the people who are leading learning functions today may not have been in similar roles at that time.
Yeah, absolutely, James. So, first of all, I'd say that whilst it is a particularly tough time now, and you could hark back to the late 2000s as a similar time where perhaps the money wasn't as abundant as it had been previously. But before I say this, I will say that it's not necessarily going to be a downbeat issue. I would say that my response to what happened in 2008 was pretty much the making of my career at Disney. I was running the UK learning and development team in 2008, and due to my response, I was able to grow my role and grow my remit. I was head of learning and development within 2 years and director of learning and talent 2 years later. And I'd say that it was due to both my response and the profile that I was able to build as somebody who got the right stuff done at Disney. So I'd say that we're in a similar situation because back then the uncertainty of the markets meant that, first of all, there was a slowdown of budgets. And then I remember that somebody from the marketing team said to me in conversation, isn't it funny how during economic pressures, it's always the learning and development and the marketing teams that are cut. And my first thoughts were, oh, blimey, I've got to do something about this. So, you know, you wait for the inevitable to happen or you grasp it with both hands. And through conversations with my boss, who was the HR director for the UK at the time, I decided that we needed to be more visible. And that was the overriding aim. If you could be more visible and more impactful, then you're not going to be seen as disposable. So what that meant was I worked closely with the HR business partners in the UK who looked after the separate business functions and reported themselves had a dotted line reporting into the senior leadership teams. So I've worked with them and said, look, what is it? Can you get me in front of your clients and customers so that I can position learning and development as helping them with team development, helping them to address any critical points of failure within their organization. So I was involved in team facilitation I remember one part of the studios for Disney Character Voices, where it was slightly dysfunctional. It was rather than a head office and lots of satellite functions, they really were a team dispersed across the world with its own dysfunctions. And so I worked closely with them in helping them to refine their ways of working. And this was over a period of time. And it was through that work that I was doing and the profile that was able to build there that I was then involved in the consolidation of different sales teams in the retail function. And again, it's a real hard hitting. I mean, the measure of success was that whereas Disney used to sell to partners from four different internal parts of Disney, which made sense to Disney, but didn't make sense to the partners and certainly didn't leverage the different different types of products that Disney had, when that was brought together, that was the measure of success. We weren't going to disappear for weeks or months designing programs and then come back only to offer programs that benefited 12 people at a time. You see that is invisible. So we needed to be seen to be visible, which was speaking with the HR business partners and their senior leaders, to be impactful, so working with the teams on what mattered most to them, and confident that we were making a difference. And that was that we were highly responsible for things working the way they should at Disney. And then when you throw into the mix, I thought, for my own self-preservation, I'll pop a learning conference into the calendar this time next year and build up some buzz and excitement around it. And that was built from my connections in the learning and development market, which again ensured my survival for a little bit longer. So that, in a nutshell, is what I did, which was hugely successful and was the blueprint for learning and development there for years to come.
So lots and lots of things I can take out of there. You know, just been jotting down a few notes as you've been talking through, but you know, thinking about lessons people can take away, and you've taken your team through and your function through a transformation from, as you said, this invisible function that disappears for weeks or months on end, creating these things that will then be launched to the business, and taking it to be more visible, more accountable, more aligned in terms of delivering against the business results and what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
What resistance did you face during that process?
Oh, James, it's funny that I don't remember us facing any resistance at all. The HR business partners really loved that approach, because they were being pushed by their clients, their senior leadership teams, to be able to offer more, because during the downturn, you know, wages are squeezed, so top talent still need to be satisfied, but maybe in different ways, with greater opportunity to improve their prospects. So HR was being squeezed, so I was the ray of light, I don't want to blow my own trumpet, for them, for HR to be seen as responding to what was going on. I think that the only downside was to what extent that we were then called upon. I mean, there was just me and Natasha, who was the L&D advisor at the time, and so we were stretched thin. But our entire ethos was that we shouldn't try to develop something new. If we were being asked to do was really involved, then we would try to facilitate conversations, almost strip out any content at all. And where we were asked to deliver content, we would be looking to repurpose what we already had. So I don't think we got any, there was any resistance at all. It was only ever us asking ourselves, is what we're being drawn into going to add the most value that we as just two people possibly could at that time? So it's more like an internal challenge.
I think that's interesting, because lots of the people I'll speak to who are considering or starting to make those transition journeys in L&D often worry about how that will be received by either their team. You know, so sometimes people are wedded to their way of delivery, or there's a set of change for the L&D team, or also for the business, that they think are actually wedded to these long programs or the more traditional approach. And, you know, it's getting out there and testing it and engaging. And I think making, as you said, making yourself visible helps to create that real benefit. Whereas if you are slightly more invisible, more detached from the business, you've probably got more concerns because you don't really know what's going on.
Yeah.
And that can be a real barrier, I know, mentally to teams I've taken through that transition in the past, but also people I speak to now who, you know, just what is going to be received? How am I going to reshape my learning team skills and approach? And that there can be challenges there, but it's interesting to see that you didn't face any of those in Disney.
Yeah, that's right. And but one of the most important things I think we did, James, was we didn't ask for permission from anybody. We decided that we were going to be more visible, and we decided the ways in which we were going to do that. And because I don't think we made any big bets, it was all very iterative, and it was all based on conversations, understanding what the real problems were, light touch solutions, and by that that didn't require a lot of development. It did take us to understand very quickly, but not go with predefined solutions. I think that we were very quickly seen as enablers, whether that was with a different approach or not. But I'll give you an example of where that comparable approach has a massive impact. I was after my Disney days doing some work with another media company, and in the analysis or discovery phase, we brought a load of middle managers together, and we had 50 middle managers together in one location, and we wanted to understand from them what it is that they were trying to do that they weren't able to do easily or effectively. So it really was an open book. We understood what they were ultimately accountable for, but middle managers, as in a lot of organizations, can be neglected because there's no immediate pressing need. So we had half a day of exploring with them through conversations, through exercises, activities, and presenting back. And at the end of this this half day session, one of the people I'd never met before the day come and shook my hand afterwards and said, "That was the best training course I've ever been on." I mean, at the time, I just sucked that up. I thought, well, that's brilliant. But as I said to somebody who was my stakeholder within there, of course, that wasn't a training course. That was just us trying to elicit from them what it was that they were trying to do that they weren't able to do easily, really, just to understand their needs in the context in which they performed. But they found the act of getting together and speaking with colleagues hugely enriching, which goes to show that we don't need to have a lot of content in order to add value. Sometimes we just need to go to people who have a real problem, understand what that is, and begin the conversation of what it will take for them to overcome it. Again, not us owning too much, but them themselves working together as a group. So again, when you're not seeking permission, and you're not necessarily telling people that you're going to take something away, add something with the benefit of understanding further, and I think that that will be well received.
Yeah, I think that's really useful, that not taking stuff away, but also the iterative approach. So you haven't set yourself up for a big bang launch that can either go really well or potentially have people throwing stones at you.
Yeah,
and I love that point you're making about just creating space for people to maybe think and reflect and discuss and converse. Because if I go back over my career, we look back and it used to be the sage on the stage and knowledge transfer back 20 years ago. And then it very quickly in my head moved to facilitation. I didn't know everything, so people, I was in a small business at the time. I was the only learning person. So it's like, how can I transfer this across? So it was all actually, I'm not the expert on all these things. I've just got to facilitate expertise. And now I feel it's more that point of facilitating organizations. So you're not facilitating a room, you're facilitating and orchestrating conversations, touch points, attitudes, all of those things. It doesn't have to be these huge events. It doesn't have to be learning content, but you're trying to get people to have that sort of moment that manager's had you've never met before, who's come, spent half a day talking about themselves or other people or listening. And that is more impactful than sitting and absorbing or not absorbing stuff when it's transferred to them. And I think, people understanding that and removing the monkey from themselves of having to own the answers or own the development and empowering other people, I think is massively important in learning.
Yeah, completely agree.
I think 10 years later from where we were facing that challenge, at the end of the 2000s, we then came into COVID, and that created another challenge for learning teams. And you're not in-house anymore, but you're supporting and working, very visibly in the industry. So what did you see in terms of the change in attitude over those 10 years from marketing and learning being the first people out the door? Has that evolved over 10 years? Did you see some of the similar things happen? What happened from your point in when we faced those challenges in 2020?
So I think that 2020 provided us with a massive opportunity. All of a sudden, the vast majority of learning and development teams that I was in touch with were focusing on the number one priority for their organizations. Now, many of them didn't know what the number one priority for the organizations was before remote working became a thing. And then it became about ensuring that people were equipped, empowered and capable to work completely remotely, and that managers were able to do their job and ensure that their teams remained engaged and productive, even though they weren't in the same room. Those were the number one priorities for organizations, and learning and development were completely aligned with them. And then there were elements of well-being, because people were no longer working from home, they were living at work. And all of the challenges that came with that. And I think that that learning and development also needed to make digital their number one means of development, which for a great number of people was seen as supplementary to face-to-face prior to COVID. And that wasn't because that was all the potential of digital. It was because the way that learning and development had co-opted and used digital, it was only ever going to be supplementary, because learning and development didn't truly believe that digital could be the primary form of development for employees. Number one, I mean, the biggest clue there was that people would only ever reluctantly use the LMS, but that wasn't because digital learning doesn't work. It's because giving people massive libraries of generic content that doesn't speak to any of their jobs doesn't work. And they knew it before we knew it. But I think that the problem with COVID and the restrictions ending is that I think that for many people, they didn't capitalize on the opportunity that was given to them before, and that many didn't continue to work on the number one priorities of their organizations, and then fell back to delivering popular stuff, which is bringing people together and then relying on the unintended consequences rather than the predetermined results, predetermined desires that their involvement was brought in to help with. So I think that we find ourselves in a strange situation, but I do think that we are at a really important inflection point, James, because COVID's happened, but there is this but we are faced with an impending skills gap, and learning and development are responsible or have been responsible for closing that skills gap in the key areas for a long, long time. There was an interesting report published by the Industrial Skills Council, which was commissioned by the UK government, and that highlighted four key skills gaps that are going to be affecting us more and more in the lead up to 2030. And they stated 2030 because 80% of the workforce of 2030 are already in the workforce right now. So we do need to develop this workforce right now in order to plug those gaps. And the four key areas that needed addressing were digital basics, which, you know, we can all get, you know, digital moves fast and people can't always keep up with that. STEM was a big issue, mainly in healthcare, so science, technology, engineering and maths. But the other two, James, will surprise you. Next is management and leadership. So there isn't the required level of skills in management and leadership. James, this happened on Learning and Development's watch. And this is despite learning and development being a $350 billion annual business or industry. This money on management and leadership, and it's still a massive problem. The fourth, James, is training. It's believed that corporate training teams do not have the required capabilities to close these skills gaps. That if learning and development can't see that this is on their watch, I don't know how loudly we need to say this anymore, that what we are doing doesn't work. It largely doesn't work. And we've got one of the biggest problems overall for learning and development is this misguided belief that buying a skills platform full of generic content is going to close skills gaps. Now, that is a win for marketing, but a loss for learning and development and organizations, because we do know, when pressed, that consuming generic content does not lead to increased capability. There's no other way of saying that. The only way that we're going to do this, and this is the change that needs to happen in learning and development, is go back to the lessons that we learned in COVID. It's aligned to the organization's biggest priorities and do the analysis from within our organizations to understand what it is that people are trying to do, or what people, what the organization expects people to do, and then close the gap between where they are now, linking technical capability with the cultural nuances of our organizations. Because these skills and learning platforms are remiss of just a few small things when they've got their vast content suites, and that is the expectations of our leaders, of our colleagues, of our peers, understanding of our systems, our processes, our hierarchies, of our cultures, our norms, our practices, any systems within that, our customers, our stakeholders, and anything related to the uniqueness of our organizations. But remove that and you've just got some pretty looking presentation skills, communication skills. There's no other way of looking at this. We need to up our own game in learning and development to understand to our role in analysis and moving the needle so that people are actually equipped to do the jobs required and not just consuming content in the hope that something magic will happen and then they'll be able to do it.
Shocking and not shocking, I would say, in terms of the things that come out there. So if we're talking, you know, digital basics, everyone, you know, should know that. Even in learning STEM, I think, again, there's huge gaps between the education system and industry still in terms of setting people up with all of those skills, whether that's STEM, whether that's the right interpersonal skills, whether that's an understanding of what work is and, you know, the evolution of work. And then management and leadership, you know, again, the amount of money you've said, 350 billion worldwide spent on learning and development, and a lot of that is burnt on nice, pretty to have flagship programs around the world that deliver limited stuff for management and leadership. And that was where I was sort of making the point earlier of sometimes taking away or challenging what are seen as those, you know, flagship programs can be someone's real comfort zone, but how impactful are they? And yeah, your point about training and learning and, you know, us having the gap there is massive. But if we come back to the overall skills gap, so much of what we see in learning and development is marketing. It's that same bit of content rebadged with a skills engine or whatever it happens to be, a skills taxonomy, and we see all sorts of things from there. One of the questions I'll often ask people is, how likely are these things to be used? And people are blindly walking into buying these things and walking into buying platforms that are reliant on managers and leaders and individuals carrying out skills assessments and therefore aligning to some generic content, which is probably at its most complex, beginner, intermediate and advanced, which is in essence nonsense. That's just a marketing package, as you've rightly pointed out. So if you were sat in Disney or in another role now and you were facing that skills challenge, just give us some practical things as to what you would be doing in your business to work through. So not the what and the why, but the how you'd go about doing that. How would you engage with your business in trying to get that skills challenge really focused on and done in a way that wasn't just go out and buy the nice, pretty skills platform, job done, 3 years of content people may or may not consume?
So the first thing I'd do, James, is stop talking about skills. Skills aren't the priority. What we need to do is understand critical points of failure, either that are being experienced now within our organization or that we can anticipate in the near future. And that can be done either from the business or, you know, somebody may benefit from, say, a workforce planning department within their teams. But it starts with a business performance or outcomes issue, not necessarily just the skills. And so what we need to do is go into an analysis of the cohort of people who are responsible for that actual work. Then we don't need to talk to them about development or about them being self-directed, about their managers supporting or gaining leadership buy-in or developing a learning culture. We talk to them about why they're in the organization and what the organization now requires from them. So we need to do then an analysis of what they are doing now compared to what it is that they are expected to do. And that is, again, it's a business conversation. And then what we do is we plug that gap, largely from within the organization, because either that that skill set plus the cultural know-how already exists, or it needs to be defined and determined, articulated, and even designed. But then those people are brought on a journey, and you could do that digital first if you ingrain it in what it is that people are expected to do. So digital resources rather than any kind of elongated course. Whenever we did this at Disney, and we're going back many years, and we had a horrendous learning management system, and it was chock-a-block full of rubbish generic content that no one used. And so we relied on accelerated mini apprenticeships when it took, say, we were looking to develop an entire country on digital capability, because they were moving from a largely physical publishing business to digital, and the average tenure of employees in Italy where we were doing this was 11 years. So what are you going to do? You're going to sack everyone and hire a whole load? You know, that's not the market that we work in right now. So there was increasing the awareness. This was some role design as well, and then mini accelerated apprenticeships of people who already worked at Disney, who were doing these roles, moved over into Italy so they could be shadowed, so they could make the way of working applicable to their Italian colleagues, and then flip the roles around, and so that they were the ones observing, asking questions, and then it's their Italian colleagues were doing it. But it's all around being laser focused on what it is that those people will be expected to do. And the way that you and the benefit of doing this over having a skills platform is, all of a sudden you're not going in with the assumption that everybody has to overhaul their skills. So you've got, say, 100,000 people in your organization. You buy a skills platform with licenses for 100,000 people. Everybody plots this path because everybody at a similar time is going to have to overhaul their skill sets. That's absolutely not true. And I think that it both oversimplifies and skews the problems that organizations actually face. What is likely to happen is, if you're looking at critical points of failure within your organization, there may be an area such as I had at Disney where there is an imminent threat that we don't have the skill sets required for the organization to do X, Y, or Z. And so if you prioritize these as a backlog in your organization rather than learning needs analysis, and certainly not as a suite of content that people can access on demand on their desktop or on their mobile, then what you're able to do as a learning and development team is do enough analysis and partnership with the stakeholders and then the people who are responsible for the work to understand. And going back to your point before, the key part of this is facilitation on the part of learning and development, not the delivery and the provision of learning content for these people to these employees to develop the required skills, but in partnership fully to understand and appreciate their role. And then bring in your subject matter experts. The vast majority of the time will already exist within your organization. So it's finding ways to elicit from them both the expectations and the technical capability that needs to be more widely shared with that cohort, and then holding those people to account, including your stakeholder, that this is what's actually going to happen. And yeah, there may be an element of education required that is then conjoined to the way that's going to be done or should be done within your organization. And you do this small and you do this iteratively. And when I see that, you know, there are people who are doing this incredibly, and I've spoken to on my podcast, people who really stand out here are Fredrik and Timu at a Swedish company called Telia, who they looked after sales capability for 5,000 people in their organization. They pivoted to a performance approach, which was grounded in analysis, data and evidence led learning and development. And now they are responsible for all of learning and development for Telia. They've won Swedish Learning Team of the Year, and Timu was recognized as Employee of the Year last year because of the results they are actually getting. And they're not trying to solve everything. Timu is one of the loudest voices on LinkedIn who, when will call out to people, your big platforms filled for the content that answer no questions or solve no defined problems in your organization is a waste of money, because he knows. And yet he's flying through work, building credibility and making real difference at his organization. So the long and the short of it, James, is don't try to plug skills gaps, try to solve business problems. And you should organize these business problems into the ones that are the most urgent right now, that people are keenly experiencing pain or imminent threat within that department, and you partner with them to fully understand where they are and where they need to go. And then you work iteratively, largely with internal groups of experts, but with very carefully chosen external stuff that actually solves the problem. And you will move at pace and you will know that you've made the required difference.
And yeah, I couldn't agree more with that in terms of, you know, going back to philosophy. I think if you start with yourself as a business person rather than a learning person, and you're there to enact performance, and you've touched on lots of different things in there, so workforce planning, you know, getting close to the business, working out what the business problem is, not the skills or the learning problem, and working through that. And I think this is where you can't be isolated and blinkered in a learning team. You've got to be aligned to your business. You've got to be highly critical. You've not got to go in thinking learning is the answer to these things, because it is a part of a patchwork of solutions. Because where we roll out the big learning platforms or the big initiatives, all they do is clog up our leaders and managers with a load of processes that they don't really believe in, or be half-heartedly delivered and deliver pretty crap results in most cases. Because if you're relying, you know, I've heard this of, you know, go out and get all your employees to assess their skills against this, and this will give you a benchmark of what you are. And my question always is, would you take that seriously if you're in your role? Would you give it more than 3 minutes consideration? Where does that data go? And then suddenly you've got, oh, we've got this helicopter view of our organization, and it gives us the skills. And it's akin to what I sometimes feel like our government do, of just managing by numbers from afar without actually knowing what's happening on the ground. And to me, you know, your approach of getting into those critical parts of the business and delivering something that is contextual and right for your business, not just the generic off the shelf content, is far more beneficial. And you talked very much at the beginning about that, you know, managing Disney through the downturn. And I think where you've got to be careful on your budget, where you've got to be focused on what you're doing, where you've got to be accountable for your results, drives better results. I've always found learning teams that have no budget or limited budget and have to do things internally become more creative, because you have to. So I think those things for people of getting in and taking those lessons of where do I go in my business? How do I start to show value, not, you know, waving the big flag, not trying to make the big noise, but just delivering through results, and then starting to build that confidence, and the results will come. One of the other things I wanted to talk to you about, and I think you've started to touch on it, was how you build an internal L&D career. So you've progressed within an organization. You haven't been one of those people who's necessarily jump ship every 2 minutes, because it's quite easy to launch an initiative, move on before it does anything, do the next thing at the set. You know, you can progress a career by lots of noise and whatever, but if you stay in a organization and you progress in there, what helped you to do that, and what lessons could you share with other people?
So I'd say that the there were two key parts to me, I think, getting the recognition for doing the right stuff, or even knowing what the right stuff was, and those were role modeling and mentoring. So role modeling for me was when I joined Disney in 2006, and I came from finance and banking, and it was a completely alien environment. Sometimes I hear people saying that that sector experience doesn't matter, but my goodness, it really was chalk and cheese. And it was not easy at all to find my way. But what I did do was, the benefit of my role meant that I did work with a lot of people, and I got introduced to a lot of people. And so I made it my mission, for want of a better word, to find people who were the next level up from me, who carried themselves in a way that was akin to how I valued myself and how I wanted to work. So I was I'd come from finance, and it was a lot more straight laced. It wasn't as creative. It was far more what I would see as traditional professional. And so I found some people, and there was one guy in the strategic sourcing team who I thought carried himself in a similar way. So I'd worked with him. I never actually asked him to be my mentor, but I did say, hey, fancy going for a coffee? And I did pick his brains about what actually works, some of the challenges he faced. Of course, in strategic sourcing, they didn't always do things that people asked. They had to be by the book and guide people to get the things they wanted done, but in the right way. And I felt that learning and development was similar there. People would ask for courses, but I'd deep down know that the course that they've asked for wouldn't actually help them. So I would give them their medicine, the medicine that was going to help rather than the medicine they asked for. And that was really important to me. I also at the same time did have a mentor from outside the organization, one of the training or the learning managers at Barclays Bank. So again, it was one foot in an industry that I did know. And what I was trying to work on was building my professional credibility, because I'd never been a training manager or a learning and development manager before. I'd run a department, but I certainly didn't have the responsibility. So I was working one element on my technical side of learning and development, and the other role modeling from an internal cultural perspective. It even went down to James when I was head of learning and development, and I had an eye on director. When I was in meetings with directors and above, I recognised that they were all wearing suits, and the people below were wearing, you know, because there was no dress code at Disney, they wearing clothes that creatives do. So I just thought, well, you know, I'll pop on a suit here, so it's part of being promoted from within is being seen to be at the next level. So you're a safe pair of hands. And I'm not saying it was the suit that did it, but it was, as a head of, I chose my peer group directors. So I would always be seen with directors. I was wearing what directors wear. I was talking with them about business issues and not about learning problems. And I had a reputation by then of getting the right stuff done. I also challenged the VP of HR. I had a good reputation anyway, and he'd say, you know, he'd be there saying, what would you do in this situation? And I'd always then be pitching how I think we elevate learning talent and OD. And so when the current director of learning talent and OD resigned, I was tapped on the shoulder. Because I'd done all the work previously, there was nothing else I could have done. I'd positioned myself and I had the track as that level, and I had the track record of getting the right stuff done. I had internal credibility with all of the key stakeholders. One piece of advice I always say to people when they're trying to position themselves for a promotion or a different level is, you've got to convince your stakeholders without telling them that you are already that level. So there are different ways in which you'll do that. And a lot of it is positioning. There's no getting away from. You have got to do the work. So I don't want to say that I didn't spend 2 years between the promotions not doing the right stuff. I was very much impact focused, but I didn't let the interpretation of my internal profile go to chance. I managed that myself. By association as much as it was about presentation. So those are the key things I did.
Yeah, I think there's a massive amount of relationship building, credibility building as part of that process. Did you have a career plan, or, you know, did you have a view as you where you wanted to go? Was it just the next level up? How were you managing that in your head?
So when I first knew that I wanted to get into training, and so this would have been in 1998, I wrote down that I wanted to be a training officer, a training manager, a training leader, and a consultant, right? So those were the steps, and I had no more information than that. And I dedicated my time to get my own training officer role, and I achieved that, and I had a standalone role for 4 years, and I bloody loved it, and I learned so much about what the profession is, and I refined those skills in the safest possible environment with so much autonomy. But it wasn't until I was at Disney that I realized that I was good for Disney and Disney was good for me, that I actually saw the levels. And then I thought, right, OK, I can definitely see my weight ahead of. I was only sitting in for in the UK Learning and Development Manager's role until they hired somebody who to replace my old boss who left. But I impressed in that role, and so I was asked to join. And almost immediately, I thought, right, I think I could get head of here in no time at all. And that's when I started role modeling and the like. And when I was in that role, I was probably in the head of role, which was only an expanded version of the UK L&D manager's role. So I was there for about a year, and I thought, do you know what? I think I can start making waves towards director. And so that's when I got another role model and started working towards it. And as a tactical ploy, I applied for the director role in Shanghai. It was almost just to let everybody else know, I think I'm ready. So, you know, I had to talk to my boss. My boss spoke to her boss. That really dragged on. What do they call that? Loud quitting, I think they're calling that in right now, where you kind of let people know that you think you're ready for something else. Quiet quitting was the phase about 5 minutes ago, wasn't it? So I think that it came in two phases is the short answer. Number one, I did have a career plan, but when I was at Disney and I recognized that this was good for both of us, then I had a progression plan. Then I got promoted to director, and I knew that I wanted to spend 2 years in that director role because there were certain parts of Disney that was driving me nuts. And I resigned exactly 2 years after I got my director promotion to go off and do something else, because I thought that was a reasonable amount of time to have that on the CV and for it to make sense. And then I did the consultant part. So I did have a plan, but it remained agile. And I think that the most important part of all of that was making the most of the Disney opportunity.
Yeah, and I think, you know, seeing that, having that plan, I think the acting up, so to speak, as in, you know, owning the space, filling the space. One of the things I saw in my career trajectory was just take the opportunities as well and align with the business, because lots of people will step away from the challenges and just, you know, you stepping in and being seen as the safe pair of hands, being seen as the person who will own some of the company challenges as well, not just start going, well, it's not my job, and start looking the other way. But I do quite a bit of mentoring of people in their careers, and I'm astounded by how little people understand about what the next level up looks like and how poor people are at researching it or envisaging what that might be. And, you know, we still hear about people at HR or L&D wanting a seat at the table. And I think, coming back to some of the things we've talked about so far, it's you can't have a seat at the table if you don't have a business view, because if you're presenting to the board is very different to being sat round the table, because you're then a business person looking holistically across all of the other functions, across everything else. And if you've started your career being that business person, having that business view, you will be in a far better place when you get further up, because you will have engaged in all of those different functions as to you're working across. And I still see it that some HR people will literally be engaged or speak up when the people issue comes up, and you can't have that narrow view. You've got to have that business person perspective first, because you've got to have a view on all sorts of other things, whether it's sales, whether it's regulation, whether it's product, whatever it happens to be in your business, you've got to be able to contribute, challenge, and be a peer. And that's part of being the peer, isn't it? The constructive challenge. So I think there's lots of things for people to think about, whereas, you know, people do think quite narrowly sometimes about, I just want to get better at my profession, or if I do a good job, I'll be patted on the head. And there's all of the subtleties around the edges of looking the part, being the part, playing the part, owning the space, being there without the title, but people assume you are one of the board or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
So what comes next for you, David? So, you know, you've for you in the industry, what are your ambitions? What do you want to achieve next?
Well, I think that the biggest opportunity we have is that we can use smarter technology to really do what we're in organizations to do. We're not in organizations to deliver learning or provide content. That is not what we're there to do. That's dumb L&D, and like anybody could do that. But if we're in organizations to truly prepare people for roles, for them to truly develop and occupy those their roles and prepare them for future roles and progression, and show that we've actually done that, that's the exciting part for me. And I think that there's too much L&D doesn't know that it makes an impact. What was that? Ross Stevenson shared something that about some research that was done in the civil service in the UK, and it was determined that that next to no training could be equated to return on investment. And I think that everybody in learning and development needs to take a long, hard look at that, and also believe that unintended consequences are not good enough to justify our involvement in any part of any business. So I think that I'm really excited about the advances in AI, that ChatGPT-3 right now is an incredible tool. I understand that Google are sitting on something. I understand ChatGPT-4 is going to blow us all away. But you just imagine that you've got software that can understand the nuances of your organization. All of the things I mentioned about understanding the culture. So the expectations of leaders, of colleagues, of peers, understands hierarchy, that understands culture, technology, customer expectations, it understands product, services, and that were you to ask any questions, it will tell you what you need to do. I mean, that is not a million miles away from what ChatGPT-3 can do right now to people like you and I. It could devise a digital marketing plan for us within seconds if we typed it in. And yeah, it's flawed at the moment, but I think that we are on the precipice now of as professionals of truly driving change and development through our organizations based on what people really need from us, and not just fulfilling their requests, which is to design and for them to attend some training. Or I've recently written an article, and I've never really analyzed it before, but when someone says to us, James, have you got anything on time management? When was anything good enough? But that's what happens, like, in the, you know, so we're not changing, we're not answering the question, how, like, have you got something that's going to help me to be better at my job right now? Here's what's going on for me, and here are the blockers. Have you got anything on time management? I think is a sad indictment on our profession and what people believe is going to actually help them. So I'd like to, going back to your question, James, I'm hugely excited about how technology and AI now is going to really help us to achieve our potential. And when we do, I think that we'll be ultimately responsible and accountable for helping people to get on in their jobs, to prosper in their current roles, improve their prospects, and for us to really upskill our organisations from within in order to have more capable workforce.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, if you've got anything on time management, well, we can already be replaced by ChatGPT on that one now, can't we?
Because exactly,
you can just ask that question. You don't need to ask the learning person, but there's so much more potential. And, you know, the technology, like you said, we're on that cusp of, you know, ChatGPT 3 moving on to 4. And again, we see this, the same people, like, it doesn't work, it's this, it's that, it's the other, but the possibilities and the people I'm seeing, you know, exploring that, and at that end of the, how do we work with this, how do we navigate this, how do we understand what's the scope, and it's that possibility, I think, for those of us at the trying to make learning what we want it to be. And you know, starting to feel like 20 years into my career, there might be something that's more positive than when I started that's really going to be at the end of that. So, you know, I think some really interesting thoughts. And David, thank you very much for joining us today. If people do want to keep in touch with you, follow you, what are the various different avenues they can use to do that?
Well, they'll find me, find the podcast. It's the Learning and Development Podcast. Find me on Twitter. I'm at David in Learning. And they can find me on LinkedIn. I'm always very vocal. And so please do connect.
So we'll make sure all of those links are in the show notes below. David, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, James.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Learning Reinvented podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you've not already done so, please follow our podcast. And if the Learning Effect can help you and your organisation, please do get in touch. You can find both James and Katie on LinkedIn, and our contact details are in the show notes below.